Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Alana Levine.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind the scenes photos, videos, and interviews and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. Little known fact about my guest today. When she was approached by Bravo about the possibility of her joining Real Housewives of New York as a cast member, she was pretty clear that that was not something she wanted to do. But she also mentioned to them that she had written a book years ago called Momzillas, which might be the perfect source material to adapt into a television show. Bravo had not yet done a comedy series, but they thought, you know what? Let's do it. Welcome, creator, star, and writer of Odd Mom Out, Jill Cardman, to the podcast.
A-OK. A-OK.
Hey, everyone. My guest today, Jill Cardman, is a best-selling author and the creator of Bravo's first scripted comedy, Odd Mom Out, in which she played a satirical version of herself navigating the hilarity of raising children on the Upper East Side in the greatest city in the world, New York City. She graduated from Yale, where she did many plays and was in an a cappella group. After graduating and working for magazines and television and films, she began writing novels. And now, I believe she has written 10. And her most recent is a comedic essay collection called Sprinkle Glitter on My Grave. She recently made her Cafe Carlyle debut with her sold-out show Stairway to Cabaret, directed by our beloved Trip Cullman.
Woo.
She hosts a radio show, The Jill Cardman Show, on Sirius XM. She's performed with the Upright Citizens Brigade. She appears in a big Hollywood movie called A Bad Mom's Christmas. For 2 seconds, but still, that residual check reflects the 2 seconds.
That's true. I got one for like $14 or something once. It was very exciting.
1.5 Starbucks.
Yeah.
Is what you could get with
exactly.
That. She is a humanitarian, which I'm in awe of because she devotes so much of her time to supporting organizations that focus on human rights. And she's the mother of three. She's married. Everyone who I told Jill Cardman was coming on my show was like, oh my God, I love her. So
that
was on
so
a loop.
Nice.
And I'm really thrilled to welcome you to this podcast.
Thank you, Alana. That is the sweetest. What a great welcome. Holy shit. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah, you've done some stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I feel it. I feel like it's been a long road and it's all over the place road with, you know, winding shit. But
yeah.
I definitely feel like this last year has been more calming. I haven't been working as much and just trying to focus on being at home and being healthy and all that crap.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about all that entails.
Yeah.
But I want to sort of go back because what was really incredible is getting to do a deep dive. I love Odd Mom Out.
Thank
and
you.
It is so, I hate the word brand, but if I had a brand and desire to write something in my brand or be a part of it, you did it. So I was like, I don't have to worry about that because Jill Cardman has just
thank you.
Taken
that is
care
so
of,
nice.
Yeah, it's just your voice. You're so funny. And it was interesting when I was doing this deep dive into your life, because the internet is an incredible place now for research, is understanding that your dad had really loved stand-up comedy in
yeah.
his early days. So Jill's mother and father, Coco and Ari Kopelman, raised their children also in New York City. And there's so much I want to talk about, but their story's incredible. And if you could just talk a little bit about what you know of how they met and who they were, even before they had you and your brother, that would be incredible.
Well, it was such a whirlwind. Before I came along, it was only like a year and a half.
A minute, yeah.
They met and married in 12 weeks, which they rose, like when we were growing up, they always said, if you did what we did, we would fucking kill you. Like they were engaged in 6 weeks. They met at Labor Day weekend on the roof of the Met, which I think is a really great New York meeting place. And yes. If you're single, they have mixers, as my parents call them. No one calls them mixers anymore, but it'll be like young patrons night in the Sculpture Garden. And that's where they met, across the roof of the Met. And he
what
saw her.
What year was that?
1971. Uh-huh. Labor Day of 1971, and she was smoking a cigarette, which was a turnoff. He said, there's this hot girl with purple suede clogs, except she's smoking, and that's a bummer. But after she put out the cigarette, he was talking to her, and she was actually there with another guy, and he somehow got her number, and it was a real, you know, romance, whirlwind romance. He proposed. She was 20, and he was 33, and he proposed at 21 Club on her 21st birthday, November 14th of the same year.
Now, her family, she comes from a French
Orthodox,
background.
French Orthodox. She grew up sitting upstairs. Her mother, her
in the synagogue.
Her mother's, yeah, in Paris, her family was in hiding during the Holocaust. They escaped Paris, and they could only afford a visa for one person. So they sent my grandmother at age 7 to boarding school in England. And then they took her little brother, my mom's uncle, and kind of hit the road. And they were never captured. They just kept hiding and went further and further and further south until there was nowhere to go. And the Gestapo came into that town. And my great-grandfather was just super chill. And he sent my great-grandmother off, and he just was pretending to take pictures with this Leica camera, and he wound up selling it to this Nazi officer who said, this is a very nice camera. And he said, thanks, and just played it so cool. And he's like, well, I want you to give it to me. And he was like, ew, no, I'm not giving it to you. And so thinking a Jew would be like, take it, take it.
Yeah.
But he just kept his cool. And then they wound up taking this other family that was in hiding with them that they had had a secret Seder with. So we still bake the cake every year that my great-grandmother, we called her, Rochelle, made with this other woman who they all died. I mean, can you believe this?
No.
So then they moved. They went back to Paris. My grandmother, Sylvette, came back from boarding school. She didn't hear from her family for 6 years. Didn't know if they were dead or alive. They teased her because she only spoke French and Italian, and she had no friends. She was Ms.
At boarding school.
Boarding school from age 7 to 13. And then she came back to Paris, grew up there, met my grandfather there. And then they moved to America and had 3 daughters. And my mother went to the Lycée Français. She was very sheltered. She was at, you know, Sherith Israel Synagogue sitting upstairs and all that. She didn't, like, wear a wig and shit, but it was, like, Orthodox.
Right.
And
but did others? Like, did her mother?
No.
Okay.
No, I guess you'd call
it
more
modern Orthodox now.
Yeah. But it was a French, it was a very European community. And then she went to Mount Holyoke at 16, and she graduated at 18. I mean, she was like a whiz, genius. And so she was working in New York and met my dad and got married at 21.
In purple clogs.
Super young.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And your father grew up here?
He grew up in Boston. He came here when he was 8 or 9 and said he looked out the back of the cab window and was like, this is where I need to
be.
Boston is small potatoes.
I remember reading that your grandfather went to Harvard, and I was thinking Harvard Law School, is that right?
Uh-huh.
And that at that time, I don't know how many Jews would have been allowed into Harvard Law School, or was he part of...
I think there were some, but very few, and there were certainly quotas against them.
So that's extraordinary already.
Yeah, and he became the youngest judge in the history of Massachusetts at 28, and he actually... His son also became a judge. My dad's twin, David Kopelman, became a judge. And but later, you know, 28, I don't think anyone will break that record. No one's going to become a judge at 28. People
Incredible.
Are like dipshits at 28.
Yeah.
Which
they should be.
I mean, yeah,
okay.
It was a different time, you know. So anyway, he was a very serious guy, really academic, never said I love you to my dad. So he grew up kind of always wanting this approval that he wasn't getting from his dad. He had a tremendously like loving, magnanimous mother, Ruth Kopelman, my Nana. And she always encouraged him.
Up?
I did. Yeah, we saw them all the time. And my grandmother actually is responsible for introducing me to my husband. We were introduced on a blind date set up by my grandma's best friend. They played bridge together for 50 years. Not her best friend, 5-0. But in her bridge group.
50 years. Okay.
They played bridge for 50 years and fixed us up on a blind date. It's so like Fiddler grandmother... on the fucking Roof.
Wait. Harry is your husband.
Yeah, I call it shtetl chic. His grandmother and my grandmother. Yeah, Betty Bloomberg and Ruth Kopelman played bridge together in the like Florida Yenta circuit.
And it
and
worked.
Fixed us up.
In their mink coats in Miami in the winter.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That is unbelievable. So your dad did have a foray or a moment in the stand-up
world. Yeah, he went to Columbia Business School, did stand-up on the weekends. He went to all the Catskills in Atlantic City and did Harrah's and all these stand-up things. And his father made it very clear that he did not approve. So he never got to pursue it. He felt like, okay, it's just something fun that I'm doing. But my dad is hilarious, so funny, always has dirty jokes, always rattling off like any
is that his
number
brand?
Of accent.
Like what's yes. his sort of like dirty jokes and
dirty jokes and mimic. He can mimic anybody. He's really funny. He can do like the old Yiddish guy or anything. He's great with accents, as is my mother. So, and she speaks four languages. She's like, you cannot tell that she has an accent in anything. It's amazing. Full polyglot. So I feel like they were kind of a match made in heaven in that she's more dry and witty and reserved, and he's a ham. She's not a ham like he is. But together, I grew up in a house with them just laughing all the time. I had such a good childhood. I'm so addicted to my parents. I mean, that's the one thing is I can't picture losing them because I'm so obsessed with them. I talk to them every day. So I'm not the most grown up 44-year-old because I'm so attached.
And so I imagine your kids are incredibly attached to your parents too.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
I felt like when I had my kids that I just kept saying like, your grandma is the real mom. Like I just would feel and still feel like as long as my mom's around, like there's a mom on board. And
totally.
I'm doing like I make lunches in the morning and I get them dressed and I love the shit out of them. But anything real, I'm like, I just have to call grandma.
We're so lucky.
Yeah.
We're so lucky. I have so many friends, especially right now with the political shitstorm hellscape, who are not speaking to the parents if they're like psycho Trump supporters or whatever the fuck mental patient people are like, whatever, voting for that guy, but or supporting those his accolades. But I just feel like relationships are more strained than ever.
I think that's
and
true.
And so I feel really lucky I have that. Because they were kind of a second set of parents to my kids in the early days because we couldn't afford a nanny. We were in a fourth floor walk up and all that. I got a nanny when my third was born.
You earned it. If you have a third.
Yeah.
You get
but I really couldn't have done it without my parents, without being like divorced in a mental asylum, whatever.
Right. No, I get it. And in seeing like all these photographs of your parents, they're so beautiful. They're so elegant.
You're so
and,
cute.
Yeah.
Well, I think if they're getting their picture taken, they're probably dressed up at a black tie thing.
But they know
so
how.
That's not,
they know how to do
I'm
it.
I'm just a normal Tuesday or anything.
Right. And so you grew up with this incredibly loving, funny, elegant, engaged in philanthropy in the world of New York and New York as your, you know, I've had a lot of guests like Laura Linney and Cynthia Nixon, a lot of these girls who grew up in New York City and this was their playground.
Yeah.
And their doorman was their babysitter and sort of just these latchkey kids, which is a very different version of it than a suburban latchkey kid.
Here's the one thing that is different, though, is that there are people who grow up in the Upper East Side and they don't leave their area. It's like they're pigeonholed in this little cosseted petri dish.
Yeah.
Whereas my parents and what Harry and I do is we use New York as like a menage a trois in our marriage. We use New York as a third parent. So we're in all five boroughs. I mean, we're not like often in Staten Island, but we're going tomorrow to Canvas for Matt Rose.
Great.
We go to, you know, an Indian restaurant where you sit on the floor in Queens, or we go to a Broadway show, or we go to an art gallery. Like, we really filch all of the kaleidoscopic things that New York has to offer. And then it's so pathetic. I meet people. I said to this woman once, I have to go downtown later. And she goes, oh, you mean like Saks?
No.
Yes.
Not what
like,
I mean.
They get fucking nosebleeds if they go below 23rd Street. And I just think, like, that's so sad. There's a whole city there. There are tons of women I know who are like, I hear Brooklyn is really up and coming. And they've never been to Brooklyn. And they live on Park Avenue. It's like, they're like, tell us where to go. Where do we go? I'm like, you wouldn't even, it's just, they just don't think of New York as a full city. Like, they just stay in their 20 block radius.
So you broke out of that mold or were never in that mold because of who your parents were.
Yeah.
And that's really fortunate that they had this worldly view and a desire to be everywhere and not in a weird ghetto.
Right.
And that's an incredible thing. When did you realize you are so funny? You're so funny. Your essays are funny. Your show is funny. Your everything you do is so smart and also so funny. When did you understand that that was a skill set that you had that not everybody has?
First of all, thank you.
You're
I feel
welcome.
So unfunny lately because I have so much rage about
That's fair.
The political shit show.
That's fair.
I guess I would say in boarding school because immediately, it was more not that I was like, dun-dun, humor. It was more just observation because I was total Wednesday Addams in Barbie Town and everyone was blonde, tits on sticks, and
when
Patagonia for
Was this high school or
14,
before?
Yeah, in high school. And so I left New York. I felt like I was 12 going on 21. I was sneaking out to the Saint and Limelight, and I was in all these places I shouldn't be. I was not, like, blowing anyone or doing coke. I just was dancing. But I felt like I wasn't getting to be a teenager. I grew up watching these John Hughes movies with Molly Ringwald, and I wanted to be a, quote, normal American, whatever the fuck that means. It means being, like, shot at your school. But I was
well,
so...
Well, it's changed.
It's changed, but I wanted that, quote, wholesome, you know, teen life. And I didn't really have it here because you do kind of pogo stick over your teens and you're 21. So when I went to boarding school, I found myself at a football game and all the stuff you just don't have as a city kid. But... So what? Like, you have other stuff.
Sure.
So, but it was, you know, I'm glad I went. I definitely was ready to leave and wanted to move on and go to college. People were sobbing at graduation. You hear the bagpipes and you hear these muffled sobs. And I was like, what's wrong with you people?
We're free.
We're free. What the hell? But there were all these parents who went there who'd come back and be like, these are the best years of your life. And I thought, if that's true, I'm just going to, like, ask Siri how to rope a noose because that's really depressing. But they didn't have smartphones then, but in theory.
No, but you would have.
I just feel like, who says high school is the best years of your life except total mediocre failures? Like, that's so pathetic.
So your mom had gone to boarding school. Was this?
No, she was
she
at
went
the
to
Lycée.
The Lycée. Yeah. So where did this, was that sort of trending? Were your friends, you went to Spence, right?
Yeah, a lot of people were applying to boarding school. My dad went to boarding school and he just was like, you know what? It's great. I think it's a good idea. First, they sort of turned their nose up at it. And then I sent the applications in without them knowing.
Okay.
And then I said, I called all the schools and made all the arrangements. And once they toured with me,
did you use
they
a different
thought it was
voice?
Cool.
Hello.
No,
Mrs.
they
Copeland.
Actually thought it was cool that the kid was calling.
She wants to go.
Then we toured them and my dad said, wow, these are really great schools. And these kids are kind of hot shits. Like, he always said, like, he was impressed by the student body. And
right.
they appeared to be that more, like, wholesome all-American thing. Whereas in the city, you definitely see kids who are a little bit fucked up. But what he doesn't know is that in the suburbs in some basement, they're all, like, doing crazy things, too.
Like, they're making crystal meth. Like,
yeah, my daughter went to camp, and she was, you know, these girls are, like, sucking dick at 13 in Scarsdale, some of them, you know. They're much faster in the burbs because there's nothing to do.
Right. Now that you have kids, could you imagine? I mean, when my kids go to sleepaway camp, I miss them so much. It's a great second honeymoon for Dominic and
oh,
I.
Oh, yeah.
There's
marriage
freedom with that. Definitely.
Total.
But I can't really. Can you imagine sending her to boarding school?
Yeah, she's
school?
There. She's in same boarding school.
So I guess you could.
Yeah, she's coming. She
yes.
comes home on the weekends.
It's fine.
So she's there Monday to Friday. She's coming home tonight for 2 days.
Is this her first year or second year?
Yeah, first year. She
so how
it.
Is that? And how is that for you?
You know what? It's great because it's my little two, my small fries. They're not that small, but they're 12 and 11. It's like their turn and they get so much more attention and we're just having so much fun and we miss her. But I FaceTime her every day. When I went, it was a black hole.
Right. There's like a payphone in some
hallway. Yeah, with 30 girls.
Right.
Now she FaceTimes me every day and we chat and whatever. And I feel like I actually talk to her more now because she needs advice about things where, I mean, she always asks for advice. We're very tight. I don't understand. Everybody says, like, oh, teenage girl nightmare,
no, but
I
don't. She's
I don't
my
have
best
that problem.
Friend in a weird way.
Yeah, me
I know.
Too.
It's very.
But I don't say that to her. I'm like, I'm not your best friend. I'm your
right.
mom.
No. But in my heart, I feel like Georgia is 15 and she gives me the best advice.
Yeah.
And I love her company.
Me too. They're like your friend now.
Yeah. It's really sweet. Both of them. So, boarding school, you kind of developed a persona.
The humor, to answer your question, yes. I made all kinds of observations about my surroundings and the homogeneity and some of the, like, the shticks about all the reversible names. Everybody had a reversible name except me because it was like Wellington Rutherford. It could be Rutherford Wellington and Roman numeral 4. And everyone was this really, you know, Mayflower Brahmin type. And right. I just was the exotic other as the Jewess. And I felt like I sprouted payas the second I walked on that campus. But I looked around me and that sort of, I guess now in retrospect, can see with the 2020 hindsight, that was the beginning of Odd Mom Out, was, you know, odd 14-year-old out, because I'm sitting there like this goth chick with my black leather jacket that I got for my bat mitzvah from Trash and Vaudeville that Jimmy Webb sold me in the 80s. And there I was on this campus where everybody, like, they cough and a Teva flies out and they're wearing, you know, jewel tone Patagonias and white baseball hats. So it was just another planet, really.
But that's such an incredible thing to both be in something, you know, I mean, there's no denying your family history. Your dad ended up being, I forget what it's called because I'm an actor, not the CFO of Chanel. What was his?
COO. President and COO.
Yes, yes. And
I don't know those corporate things either.
I'm always like, he's very high up and very important and can bring us products home. I assume he brought product home. Did you get to have kind of lots of lovely Chanel?
I got the beauty stuff, but they never let me get a Chanel bag. And I would beg. And when I turned 16, I had friends who had Chanel bags. And they said, well, their parents are terrible parents because they will have nothing to look forward to.
Right.
And that's really pathetic that they're getting a Chanel bag at 16 and they're spoiled brats. So you're not getting one. So I saw all my friends getting them. It was weird, but that wasn't their style. And I appreciated it when I got one at, you know, 30 or something.
I love your parents so much.
They're so cool.
They're so extraordinary because it is very, I mean, I was thinking that about you. Like, how do you live in the middle of something? I mean, your ability to be both in it and observe it at the same time is a really incredible thing, to kind of understand how to value what you value, laugh at what you laugh at, and to travel in it and outside of it at the same time is no small thing.
That was all my parents, because they would come home from parties and things and comment about people who are flashy or just conspicuous consumption or people, you know, so I their values, it's all just osmosis living in the apartment with them.
Right.
But then when I went out on my own, I had the same power of observation and, you know, understanding that people say things without thinking, you know, you almost want to tape record them. But I remember, especially as a kid, I was an intern at Mademoiselle and Harper's Bazaar. And my dad said, with both internships, I just want to make it clear, you didn't get this because you're so great. You got it because I made a phone call. So you're going to be the first person there at 8 in the morning, and you're going to be the last one to leave. And I said, well, Dad, some people aren't even there at 8. And he's like, you just sit there and you be there when they all walk in and you ask if you think you can fetch them a coffee or re-alphabetize their Rolodex.
Right.
When that was the thing.
But they also had an incredible aesthetic. And you, I feel like you and Cate Blanchett, like the two of you.
Ooh, when how could you even say me in that? She's like another stratosphere.
I don't know.
I worship her.
I do too. But then doing a deep dive into your fashion sense, like, you have impeccable taste and it's
uniquely yours,
but it's beautiful. And somehow you've intuited and absorbed this really beautiful, unique aesthetic and grew up with an appreciation for art and beauty, and your parents were really involved in philanthropy and supporting the arts in New York, and so there's an awareness of that.
There is, but I have my mother is a truly stylish person. She just puts together anything, and it's beautiful, and she dresses like a normal human being. My mom teases me and calls me the Sicilian widow because I only wear black. I don't look good in color. I'm so pale.
Do you like clothes? Do you like
fashion? I love clothes, but I really only like black clothes. So I'll be leafing through a thing and they'll say, oh, do you like this? You know, emerald green is really in right now. And I just said, no. I mean, look at me. I call it cadaver chic. I look exhumed from a grave. If you don't know my face, I'm very, very pale. So I don't look good in color. I mean, occasionally I'll wear like burgundy is stepping out.
Right.
But
I just wear
black every day. So I feel like truly stylish people take way more risks than I do.
Well, that being said, I really love your style.
Oh, thanks.
And I want to say that, you know, people may not be aware, because Odd Mom Out became a very popular show very quickly. And so many eyeballs who, you know, people were watching that network because of all the Real Housewives and all this other stuff. It was a very new thing for that network to take on a show that had a world that Real Housewives of New York covered, but doing it from a very different perspective. I knew you wrote a book called Momzilla,
mm-hmm.
and I know that in some ways that might have planted the seeds for Bravo to adapt that into a scripted series because it makes sense. But I think what's astonishing is that you acted in Yale, as I said in your bio, and obviously you were an actress and loved doing it. But the idea that really, in earnest, it wasn't until you were almost 40 years old that you were on television and that you got to do it completely on your terms is the most inspirational thing. And
oh,
my listeners
yay.
Are going to flip out just knowing there
you know,
are...
I'm like, I became an actress at 39.
Yes, and or revisited. Yes, like revisiting this passion in this really... on your own terms and in this incredible way. And I think people often feel like, oh, that's not going to happen for me and don't understand how things... You know, sort of there's this map and you can go off and on it in all these ways. But that was the most not graceful metaphor. But I do really think it is an extraordinary story. So when you got out of school and you were at Yale and you were an undergrad doing plays, who were people that you went to school with who ended up doing it?
Okay, you're going to die. Bobby Lopez, who wrote Frozen, who's a billionaire.
Heard of it.
I was in his first musical. Can you believe that? With Trip Coleman. So, and I ran it to him. I was like, Bobby Lopez, hi. It's almost ridiculous because I'm like, I'm a zero because he wrote Frozen. And he's the youngest ever EGOT.
Incredible.
It's so funny.
Yeah.
There were a lot of performers who I knew were going to go be actresses. And they always said from day one, I'm going to be an actress. I'm moving to New York. I'm moving to LA. And I never said that to anybody because I'm a workaholic and I always need to be working. And I knew I didn't have, part of it was balls, but part of it was also just the strength to wait between auditions and all that because I needed a job. And partly it was financial, even though I lived with my parents, but partly it was because I am a jackrabbit and need to be working. So I went right to magazines because that was all my experience in the summer.
But when you were at Yale, were you getting good parts?
Yeah, I had great parts. And then when I left, when I bowed in my last show, which actually wasn't a good part. Well, I was the Yellow Brick Road in The Wiz. So weirdly, I sang Ease On Down the Road. It was weird. They just try to make it more equitable. But I bowed and I said to myself, like, that's my last time ever on a stage. That's so sad. And then it was for 18 years until I did Williamstown. So it was crazy. And I got on that stage in Massachusetts and said, this is my first time on a stage in 18
that's
years.
What, because you did the cabaret there before it came to New York.
Yes.
That's what you're referencing.
Yes, exactly.
So when you were at Yale, did you also focus on writing? Did you write stuff for yourself to perform?
No, I didn't take one English class.
Not a one.
Not one. I took French, Spanish, and Italian all the way through. I loved languages and I find them easy. So I graduated in 3 years. I skipped my junior year because I saved my parents like $45,000.
So you just like took tons of courses and lots of credits
well,
and they piled up?
Yale, you have to take 36 credits. So I started taking six the first semester and most people take four or five. So you take nine a year and I took 12 a year. I was just going to bag whichever one was dumb and boring, but
right.
They were all cool. And so I just stayed afloat with that. And then my dean said, you can graduate in 3 years. You're taking all these classes. But, you know, in boarding school, you have school on Saturdays. So I felt like I had too much free time.
Right.
Even with the play.
This was breezy.
It was breezy compared to high school. High school sucks. It fucking sucks.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just felt like I was never going to pursue acting. So then my dean called me and said, there's a think tank here who wants to speak to you. And I went in and I was like, hi, like, why am I here? And they said, you're the seventh person in the history of the university to take three languages. They wanted to recruit me for the CIA.
Oh my God.
I was like, well, then I have to like blow fat people in the desert. You're like, no, for secrets.
Is that what
I read Daniel Silva books. You're a honeypot and you have to bone terrorists. I'm good.
You have to do.
I love my country, but not that much. So anyway, it didn't even occur to me that to go be an actress because I did think you have to be like blonde and blue-eyed and
right.
Probably blow people and casting couch and all that. But I just felt like no one looks like me in movies.
And were you doing any comedy stuff? Like,
no.
None of that?
No.
No improv, no Upright Citizens Brigade at the time?
No, I did Upright Citizens Brigade at 42.
Oh, my God. So you get out of school and you start writing and you have this unbelievably wonderful singular writer's voice.
Well, that I had really at 20. I had that the second I got to magazines and I
you knew
really
how to do
hated
it.
My job. I was at Interview Magazine.
Okay.
Started by Andy Warhol. And
who had been your neighbor, right?
He was my childhood
Just,
neighbor.
By the way.
But he didn't know me. First of all, he was dead when I got the job, like the 10 years later. I was, you know, it's a really small scale magazine. So if I had been at Condé Nast, I'd be walking the dog of Cameron Diaz's second assistant or something. But at interview, they let me write at 21, 20.
And were you pitching stories to them, or were they assigning you? Like, what
was the
first
pitching
thing?
Well, it's funny because Ingrid Sishi, the late editor-in-chief, she would always ask if they were attractive and stuff. And I was pitching people and they weren't. Finally, I came in. I'm like, there's this girl who's really pretty named Fiona Apple.
And she was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, well, I interviewed Gwen Stefani when she was 26. You know, it's weird now looking back. I interviewed Mike Myers, and they would just send this kid. I mean, I was an idiot with a tape recorder. I'd never interviewed anyone. I didn't go to journalism school. You know, it was kind of guerrilla-style renegade. I got to, but then I transcribed it myself, and I was doing assistant duties for everybody else. But, you know, I wasn't that happy there, but I definitely look back and realize I was so lucky to be there and write all these articles. And I signed a contract saying I wouldn't write for anyone in America, but I could. I sent all my clips. I would Xerox them and send them to editors in London. So I became this New York stringer for a lot of magazines and interviewed, you know, actors and actresses for magazines abroad, like British Vogue, British GQ, whatever. So it was cool. I had like a good little freelancer career.
And all personality pieces at the time, like covering.
Well, no, some of them were just like my own rants about things. And they let me do kind of a every other month column. What's that called? Bimonthly?
Yeah.
Or is that every 2 weeks?
I don't know anyway. What it's called when you work in a company or math. I can't do either.
But yeah, I did columns and they gave me a tremendous amount of freedom.
And when you first started, because so often in any field, like there, you sort of mimic people you admire at first, styles or actors or singers. That's how you find your own. Were there writers when you were starting that you wanted to emulate or be like or worship?
I worshipped Woody Allen, and he was to me my dream writer. Not just all his movies, but all of his New Yorker essays, all of his essays, Without Feathers and all those books. I loved Fran Lebowitz, Cynthia Heimel. You know, I just would read and giggle out loud. And I thought, if I can write something that makes people laugh, that's a gift, because Cynthia Heimel made me laugh my junior year of high school, where I was like in my depressing dorm room with paint chipping off. It looked like Orange is the New Black. And she made me cackle. So that was the best inspiration. The other inspiration was the shitty writing out there, because I thought, why are they allowed to do this? I could do this.
Yeah.
So it was just as much the crap writers as the good writers.
And when you sort of forayed into film and television, I would assume everything you wrote pretty quickly really was great content to be adapted into these other media. I mean, television, obviously Odd Mom Out eventually became that. Were things being bought or optioned to be made into films or TV shows once you sort of...
It was the most frustrating, torturous thing. All my books were optioned and none were made. So at the first couple times that my agent would be like, guess what? This movie studio is buying your book.
You
get the
thought,
champagne.
Right.
You know, I was a dumb kid. Right. I didn't know. I was 28 or 9. And I said, you guys, my book's going to be a movie, like soon to be a major motion picture. Crickets, nothing.
Right.
They buy it. They put it in a vault. I had a 2-movie deal at Paramount. Nothing. So I felt like a fraud or something, because it would be there it was in Variety, but then nothing happened. So it started to get embarrassing as a writer, because people were like, what's happening with your movie? And I was like, I don't know.
You tell me.
Yeah, it was a bummer. So, but I wrote for MTV, and those were very much, that was before I was in the union or anything, because it was non-union. But
What were you writing for them?
I worked in MTV News Docs, which was like, I did a show called Who Is, which was sort of like Annie biography. It was a really big deal at the time. So we did kind of our half hour version for like a shorter attention span on a band. And I would, you know, call the stuff and write it. But then we did a show called Who So 5 Minutes Ago. That was a trend report about things that are so 5 minutes ago that are over. Like, remember this thing? And that was really where I felt like I was in this fun mile-a-minute factory, shitting out copy, and then it would be on TV the
Amazing.
Next day, and I saw my name.
Right, and that's
on the
satisfying.
TV screen.
It
and
happened.
It was very exciting for me, and I got paid peanuts. And then the weirdest thing happened. I got knocked up. I was already married, so I wasn't really knocked up, but
Thank
I got
you,
pregnant.
Grandma.
And I showed up. I was 28. I showed up at the office, and they never called me again.
That's
they thought
disgusting.
I lost my edge.
What?
Yeah, they were like, what the hell? And they were like those 36-year-old Williamsburg hipsters with the messenger bag, rejuvenile, sleeved in tattoos. And I was 28. I was younger than them. But because I had a bun in the oven and I was a big fat person, they just thought, oh, she's not cool. She's not lost her edge. And they never called me again because I was a freelancer. So they'd hire me project to project like for 3 months or 6 months. Never. Crickets.
Were you having kids?
Isn't that like, weird?
No, it's not. It's weird. It's actually really upsetting and bums me out because I think that, frankly, that's still happening all over the place in different versions of that. Mm-hmm. And people still feel like they have to make a choice or try to hide it. Or did you feel like you were having kids at the same time that your friends and peers were having? Or did that
No.
feel early to you?
Oh, it was totally early. My friends were dancing on tables at Bungalow 8 and fucking car mechanics when their car broke down. And I had three kids.
You were throwing up.
I had three kids in 4 years.
And was the first one a planned pregnancy?
It wasn't not planned. We were just like doing that Irish pull and pray method.
Yeah.
Like if you do that, it's like, what do you call people who use the withdrawal method? Parents. But we were like, okay, we're married. So.
But
whatever.
You got married young too.
Yeah, I got married at 27.
Right. Was that a whirlwind romance?
You know, it wasn't for me because my parents had gotten married in 12
right.
weeks.
You had
so after
clogs.
A year, after yeah. a year, I was like, dude, shit or get off the pot. Like, I didn't say that
you
to
wanted
him,
to be married.
I wanted to be married. I knew it was him. You know, I was engaged twice before Harry, by the way. I was
Ooh.
Like runaway bride. No,
okay.
not at the altar, but I was engaged twice. And so when I met Harry, we stayed out really late. We went to Marie's Crisis. We had the best date.
Did you sing?
I sang my little fucking lungs out and he didn't know any words, but he was happy. Until some guy grabbed his ass and said, why are you here with your mother about me?
What?
Yeah.
What?
I was like, oh, fuck you.
Okay.
So then we were walking around. He put me in a cab and I came home to my old shitty apartment and the phone was ringing and he's like, hi, I just want to make sure you got home okay. Cute, right? So there were no cell phones back then.
Right.
Back in my day, I have a walker here with tennis balls on it.
You
there
really
were no
do look
cell
amazing,
phones.
Though. Yeah.
So the next morning I went to my Sex in the City brunch with Vanessa, who
yes,
you met.
I just met the
and
lovely Vanessa.
I said, I met my husband last night. It was like out of that Sex in the City brunch of like, guys, I have an announcement. He didn't know that so fast about me, but within 6 months, we were living together. So we hit the, it was normal. I wouldn't say it was whirlwind. It was normal.
And he has a media company?
Yeah, he's in tech. I call him Geek Chic.
Do you understand what he does?
Not at all.
Are you interested?
No.
Okay. Okay.
Not at all.
Well, your lives got public in a way, because even though you weren't doing Real Housewives of the Upper East Side, your show really, Odd Mom Out, really brought so much of you to it, even though the character was named Jill Weber mm-hmm. instead of Jill Cardman. Was there any doubt in your mind about whether to keep your last name or take Harry's last name? And how did you make that decision? Or did you just like his name better?
That's a good question. There was no doubt in my mind because my mom took my dad's name. And I just felt like growing up in the 80s, this is totally wrong and stupid. I admit this. But for some reason, I had this thing in my head, which is wrong, that the couples where the mom had the maiden name in my class at Spence, like they weren't as much of a unit or something because it was very new.
Yeah.
And so I kind of always thought like, of course I'll take their name. Now, if I married, you know, Harry Schitsky, probably not. But
right.
Cardman was the same letter K. You're and a man. So you're swapping an arg for an opal.
Exactly.
So I mean, you know, yeah, I didn't even really think about it.
Okay.
I cried the first day, the first night. I wrote my dad a letter thanking him for my wedding and I started crying. And I was like, why does a woman have to change her name? This mm-hmm. is bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, maybe I do want to keep my name. But it was too late because I had already like filled out paperwork and told Harry I was taking it and all that.
Is he funny?
No, but he's such a good audience.
That's all we need.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Yeah.
All right.
He's
so
cute. He can be funny sometimes.
He seems really
even
cute.
A broken clock is right twice a day.
There.
No, I'm kidding. No, he's the sweetest guy in the world. I'm so fucking lucky.
Yeah. You are. He seems really nice.
He's the nicest, but not nice boring.
Right.
He can laugh at the mean stuff, too. He's not somebody that if you say something mean, they're going to be like, oh, come on.
No, he
Fuck
gets
those
it.
People.
He's totally
yeah.
fine.
I don't like too nice.
So Momzilla, this obviously we're jumping around because your life is so colorful and amazing and accomplished. And also what I really love is it seems, not to use the Sex and the City reference, that you do have this incredible, loyal posse of women.
I do.
That you
My
you
five
have,
best friends
yeah.
are my they're my life. Like, this is so mean because a lot of people move to New York and they're new here, right? So their school becomes their community or whatever. But I'm sometimes wary about people who always have new friends, or like this mom, I asked another mom in our class to be the godmother of her new baby. I'm like, you just met 2 years ago. Like, right. What the fuck?
That's weird.
But then I feel guilty saying that because they're new here maybe, but my bridesmaids are my best friend. Not to say I didn't weed the friendship garden in my 20s. You know, you have some friendships that are just inertia that you keep around. And then at some point you have to say, you know what? I don't feel good when I'm with this person, or they're toxic in some way. I didn't have many of those, but my core five are still my best friends.
And are they like college, Spence, Taft?
One Spence, two Taft, two college.
And they all love each other too.
Yeah, now they do. Cause they all met like when we were in our 20s in New York, and two are now in Boston and three are here.
You know, I want to get to Odd Mom Out in a deep way. But I also know now like you're adapting the Munsters for new.
Oh no, they passed. NBC passed.
Did you hear that, folks? NBC passed. So it is
back.
Fuck
the Peacock.
Out. If you want to do it someplace else, you can buy it. Do you feel like you were always super confident, or are you not super confident but really good at seeming like you are?
No, I feel like I'm confident because I really know who I am. And I think because I was like, when I was a kid, I felt I wasn't confident because I just felt like, oh, I'm so zitty. Like literally Ray Charles could read my forehead. I had cystic acne. And then I remember my doctor being like, there's this brand new thing called Accutane. But anyway,
yeah.
Then I was like, oh.
But was that your like middle school or high school life? Like feeling like the girl covered with zits? Or?
No, no, I wasn't. I don't know. I weirdly got it. I guess you just have to hone your personality if you're not a looker.
Yeah.
So I've honed my personality. And also, you know, I had parents who were like, it doesn't really matter. And if I was at a Chanel show and they're all the models and I'm standing there looking at these like Rexy skeletons looking beautiful, my dad would say, don't worry, people like a little meat on the bones or something. He would try to make me not want to go and jump out a window from seeing models my whole childhood.
Sure.
So I didn't really obsess about things the way that some people do. But I don't know. I guess I feel confident just, I'm good at just being me, but it's not, I know you said like my life's colorful and everything and I do love my life, but my life's pretty boring. Like at home, we like to stay in a lot right now. And I had a phase where I felt like, when you were saying, you know, with camp, how it was marriage defibrillators for me, where I felt like I'm losing myself in motherhood, and I had shot out 3 kids in 4 years, and I was desperate to get back to that balsamic reduction of myself because I was very diluted because I was just in
giving a lot to
zone
a lot
defense.
Of people. Yeah,
totally. So that's when I felt not confident. Not so much not confident, and I don't know. I just felt like I was slipping away, and I was just so-and-so's mom. I wasn't me. And then as they got older and I got out of that and I felt like I reinvested in my marriage and, you know, knew that it was fine to go away and ditch them
and
with
be,
my parents.
And be creative also, right?
So, well, that was a big part of
that's
it.
That's huge. So how did you get to, because a lot of people write things and they get bought and do get made, but they're not in them. That's just not part of the bargain. So how did, not only did Momzilla become a series called Odd Mom Out that is loosely based on your life with tremendous humor and thrown in for good measure, how did you get to play the lead in it?
It's so funny. It never was even an issue. They wanted me to do a reality and have me on camera. And I said, I'm a writer.
Not a Real Housewives character. They didn't want to add you to Real Housewives. They wanted you to do your own thing.
There was a discussion, like just a general quote unquote meeting about that. Here's the interesting thing that people have to understand. My trajectory, I took a huge step backwards because I had all these things optioned. I thought one of them's going to go and this is so great and I'll be a screenwriter in the guild. And then I just was like, I have no money. Like I was panicking. Harry started his own company and I was like, I have to get a job. I have to go back to work. So did I go to something glamorous that could move the ball forward? No, I was writing tampon commercials. I went to Ogilvy. I was brought in as a freelance writer, like the way I did at MTV.
Right.
And I was probably there 3 days a week. And I was doing copy. I was doing this panty liner. And it was a commercial with, like, it never got made. But it was people, of course. But I got a salary.
Yeah.
And it was people laughing about things. And then, you know, a little pee comes out if you have kids. So my pad, it said, like, I wrote, you're in the clear. urine.
Got it.
Anyway, I was pitching the stuff, and the producer said the client really liked you. They thought you were funny in the meeting when I was pitching it. And I think they brought me in, like in Mad Men, where they bring in the Jew for the Jewish client. The guys were all, it was all guys. So right. I think it would behoove them to have me come in. But they were awesome. And afterwards, one of them said, have you ever considered being on television? You were good in there. And I said, okay, yeah, sure, I'll just go be on television then. He's like, no, I'm serious. And I said, okay, like how? And I'm sitting in this job that was kind of treading water just for the money.
Right.
And it was those producers who had the idea to go in and meet with Bravo to pitch them this other show that we wanted to do, which was a morning show called Wake the Fuck Up for like a streaming or cable, whatever. And Bravo passed on it, but said, we want to meet with her. And this casting director had actually emailed me randomly saying, we hired three casting directors, different casting directors, to come up with lists for Real Housewives. And your name was on all three lists.
Interesting.
Can you come to lunch at Le Cirque, the old Le Cirque?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, thanks. Like, I'll never have a camera at my butthole. That's never happening. And they're like, it's just a meeting. You know, we'll have a nice meal. I'm like, thanks. I can like buy my own chicken breast. Like, we're good. I'm not
this.
Like, feed me.
Yeah.
So,
did you know any of the housewives? Why do you think?
But no, just somehow, I just think I'm a New Yorker.
Yeah.
And I wrote these books about that world.
Yeah.
So, I wound up doing the meeting with Andy Cohen and Lara Spots. And he's like, okay, well, let's just say we did, you know, there was another reality show we developed, not Housewives, but something else that's more comedic. Cause I said, I don't like drama and people yelling at each other and whatever. And I said, look, NBC, your parent company, owns my book, Momzillas. Can't you just like reach over and take it? And he said, that's not how this works.
Yes. But it should be.
I said, I don't see why. And they were just branching into scripted. So it was kind of exciting because it was the Wild Wild West. And I essentially pitched them for a year trying to do this. And he introduced me to Lara Spots, his head of development, who became my showrunner. And we just really clicked. Like, she got the show. She knew what the show was. And the more that I came in doing shticks about what different scenes could be, she got it. So they finally said, we will have you make a pilot. It wasn't even a real pilot. It was called a sizzle. So instead of 30 minutes, it was 15.
So you did a couple of scenes. Did you do random scenes or like the first three scenes of the show?
It was more like a, you know, condensed Reader's Digest of what the pilot was that eventually aired. It was the SoulCycle scene. It was me on the street with these moms with $1,000 strollers running me over practically, and all with the nannies walking behind them, and the Brooke character being 9 months pregnant but having no stomach and saying, I'm so fat. I'm like, I'm, you know, Homer Simpson. And then SoulCycle. And there were like a few scenes, but it was more condensed, and then it came, same thing, where I'm home with my kids, just like, this is, you know, we can be kooky and be ourselves here. But it was that the two brothers that we were married to, one had sold his company for,
which ended
all this
up
money.
Being true.
Yes.
In the series.
In the series. Yeah, all of that stayed. It was just kind of more of a shrunken version.
So you got to do three seasons,
mm-hmm.
and were you hoping there would be more? Or
yes,
were you ready?
I'm devastated when we
what
were
happened?
Canceled. I was so sad. I think that they decided they're not doing comedy anymore, just scripted drama. They said that their audience craves drama because there's like cat fights on Real Housewives, and they made other dramas, and they said their audience craves drama. That was the phrase we heard. And so comedy, they don't really think it's like a destination for comedy. So it's not anymore. The cool thing about being the one and only is that we didn't have a sort of a head of comedy that was riding us. We had so much freedom. So I felt like when no one was looking, I got to make the show for 3 years.
That's incredible.
Like, I feel like I stole, like, getting to make a show. It was so silly and crazy.
And now you know everything about making a show.
Yeah, I learned a lot.
Right?
It was a crash course.
You hit the ground running, and now you've made a TV show, and you started it and wrote it and produced it, and you did it, and it lives forever, and it's fantastic.
What I never want to do is direct.
Is that
true? Am I the only person who's ever said that?
Well,
directing is torture. I can't believe people want to direct.
What is it about when you say that? What are you picturing that's like, that's the part I do not like?
Oh my God. It just like looking at storyboards and the lighting and the cameras and,
don't care.
And also having to make an actor feel like coddled enough that they're not being insulted, but try to coax out a different person. Like everything about directing, I think, sucks.
And would you be in the room when they were casting?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny. At the beginning of season one, I thought, this is like a chorus line and I'm excited and this is going to be fun. And after 2 hours, I said, I hate this. I had so much anxiety watching people.
Right.
I'm not a power tripper, so I didn't like it. Some people like get off on it or something, and I don't. I thought it was really traumatic. And I said, I just want to watch the tapes now. So I watched the rest on my computer.
That's great. And yeah. then you just know, because it's like you just want to tell everyone, like, I don't know if you're going to get it or not, but you were amazing. And I mean, you're a very given person. And you,
I am giving, yes. and I felt really bad. I've had like diarrhea for them.
Well, I'm glad that you know that about yourself.
Yeah.
It's important to know what you want to do.
I will never sit in an audition again.
And you will and you may end up directing or you may not end up directing.
No, no,
but it's okay.
Never.
You've heard it here, folks. I want to just I want to just move very quickly to the fact that you ended up doing what many women are scared to do but really need to do for the sake of their own life and the quality of life for the people around them, which is to do the BRCA test.
Yes.
And you found out that you, in fact, were predisposed.
Yeah. So I actually first failed my mammogram. They said you have two lumps in your left boob. And I was really scared. And they were doing a biopsy and said these are like pre-cancer mm-hmm. and they're not good and we have to... They basically said, like, this is really bad. Like, these are going to turn.
So you had that moment.
I had that moment. And then I had the genetic test already scheduled.
Okay.
And then they said, you have a gene called CHK2, which is a breast cancer gene also. And it just was like a no-brainer. I mean, so many people said to me, well, this must have been such a hard decision to get a double mastectomy. And I said, nope, not at all. I didn't even think about it. I went sort of in a daze. We met with surgeons. At Cornell, Alexander Swistel was like, I can save your nips. Mm-hmm. So we went with him. And, you know, now I have like the boobs of an 18-year-old. Was it a great year? No, it was horrible. Like I had the drains. I had all this drama in there in my life at the time. And I just, you know, but I never look back. I never regretted it or anything. And my gyno said all her patients who have had the gene have elected to do this. And especially with lumps, you kind of... The oncologist, because I had melanoma before at Sloan Kettering, and I have a foot-long scar on my leg, and they took the lymph nodes out of my vag, so I have another scar on there on, like, the Mons Veneris region. Let's get scientific. And
you know a lot now.
I do. But my surgeon said, it's not if, it's when. So I felt like my boob was a time bomb, so why wait?
Was there breast cancer or cancer in
all
your
over.
Family?
All over.
Okay.
And I mean both sides, everywhere.
Right.
Grandmother was dead at 46. My aunt had stage 3. She died at 49. My dad's twin brother's daughter had it. It's like all over both
right.
sides.
So it was so clear that you needed to take this test, and it was so clear that you
yeah.
were going to do it.
And I'm 44. So that's – my grandmother was dead at 46. Like, I don't want to go anywhere. Like, this was a no-brainer.
Yeah. So it was about a year, you would say, where like beginning to end of going through everything?
No, it was – no, because I did my – May was my first surgery, and August was my second surgery. To get my Stormy Daniels. No, I didn't go bigger. I just wanted like to repair.
It's times like this. I'm so sorry. This is an audio experience.
Yeah, you guys. I have C's. All right. I have smaller cams.
She looks
than
very
her.
Pretty. But then in terms of healing and in feeling like yourself again,
I'm still not 100. I feel fine. Like mm-hmm. I feel fine. It's weird looking in the mirror and seeing like boing.
Yeah.
But I feel a little bit like emotionally. Sort of vulnerable. And I guess that has to do with, and I'm not agoraphobic or anything, but like really crowded rock concerts or things that I used to never care about being smashed against people. I feel a little more protective
right
now. And also, excuse me, I lost a lot of blood. So when they did my hemoglobin check, they said it was supposed to be 100 to 290 and mine was 6. So I had to get transfusion and I've been doing this iron drips and all this crap. So I definitely feel like tired. I just thought, oh, all moms are tired.
Right.
I'm just a busy New York person.
Right. But no, there's an added.
Yeah. So I feel like I kind of chalked up this year. My ambition has always come in droves, like ebb and flow. And this is just not a very ambitious moment in my life. I'm just trying to focus on being home and being relaxed and not stressed about this and doing my infusions. And, you know, I feel so lucky because I go to this Eastside Oncology to get my iron drips and everyone else is doing chemo.
Right.
And I'm sitting there like, okay, you have no problems.
Right.
These people are vomiting and bald and you have no problems. Like anything that's stressing you out just doesn't matter. So going through this, it didn't make me really feel weak. It made me feel strong too. But, you know, it oscillates.
Right. But you're such a just having you on the show and just letting people hear, like, that test works.
It's really
important to listen to.
And it's really important to get mammograms.
Yeah.
Because that's what found it. And by the way, the year before to the date, September, same year before, totally clean. Mm-hmm. So in 1 year, it can all change. And these two lumps showed up. I don't know where the fuck they came from, but
right.
They're like buzzing from the lobby. Like, we're coming. It was so weird. You have to do it consistently every year.
It's so unexpected. It's also unexpected. You read about it and then it's happening to you and that's it.
Yeah. And I was able to circumvent the chemo, which so many of my friends have gone through and they were so sick and the side effects were awful. And I just kind of skipped over that. So I feel so lucky. That's why I didn't feel sorry for myself, even though it was no picnic with the drains and all that shit. I thought people go through this and then have chemo. So I'm so lucky. I bypassed it.
Yeah. And I'm sure you really felt your community there.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Like, my friends were such a good friend. And then suddenly you were the vulnerable one. And is it hard for you to take in help or to get attention?
Yes.
So that was another lesson you had to learn, like to say yes to people wanting to love you
and
do things
for you. I like attention for good stuff, like if I do a show or something. Yeah. But I don't like attention for being weak or something. And a lot of friends, sort of those secondary, tertiary level friends, mm-hmm. were like, I'm mad at you. You didn't tell me. I would have helped you. And I said, that's why I didn't do it, because I didn't want to scare my kids and have 20 flower arrangements there. So I only told Tripp and my five best friends.
Right.
And that is it. Nobody. And my parents. But I did not put out the word, because I didn't want balloons hanging from the ceiling, because it would freak my kids out like something's really wrong with her.
That's right. Well, how do you think about success? What does it mean to you? Do you feel successful? And what is success to you?
That's such a good question. It's funny. I don't feel successful right now because my show is canceled. Mm-hmm. So, and then the Munsters, I was so excited about that. And then that didn't get picked up. So I was like, oh, I guess I'm not successful anymore. But then I just stop and think like, look, this health thing, that's really all that matters. Health is all that matters. And I'll do something when I'm ready. I just feel like you have to focus on your personal life first, because there are people who are so quote successful and then they're Ms. at home or whatever.
Right.
And I'm happy just like holding up right now. I don't have a huge social life at the moment because I don't really have that great a time at parties lately. I don't know why. I just feel like a lot of small talk that people do, I don't know. And my boobs were like the elephant in the room for a while. Yeah. And I wrote an essay about my mastectomy. So I went to this first party and people are inadvertently looking at my cans.
Right.
And Sadie, my daughter, said, what do you expect? You wrote about having a double mastectomy. Of course they're going to look at your cans. And I was like, I know, but it's weird. I feel like I have two Jasper Johns, like bullseyes there.
Well, so it's one thing to put it on paper. That's such a private event. To write something is such a private thing. And it's very hard to imagine it going out into the universe. It's just for
weird.
You. And you're putting these thoughts down.
I know, but I have like a kind of Tourette's syndrome with writing. Like, I just shit it out because it's better for me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like better once I get it out there. It's an emotional zit that I have to pop.
I want to say that I appreciate that you do it for you, but the amount of pleasure and laughter and entertainment and thought-provoking material that you have written, acted in, wherever you've written it and however you've put it out there has been, I cannot tell you how much joy you have given me.
Oh,
and
thank you. I'm going to cry.
Don't
so
cry.
Nice.
It's just so true. And you're just such a special, uniquely gifted human. And every single person, I said at the beginning, when I tweeted out or talked to people about how thrilled I was to have you on this show, the ripple effect you have of making people feel good about what they do. Like, every actor on your show, they went in really intimidated. Like, there you are playing yourself. It's not like you're there and you know it backwards and forwards. And it was intimidating. And the way you put everyone at ease immediately and made them feel talented. Television
but they are
moves
talented.
Very fast.
No, they're so good. Like, all those guys you mentioned, Christopher and Mike, and I just felt, it's funny, I felt the opposite. I felt like they're the real professional actors who have spent 20 years honing their skills, and I'm just like, hi, I'm playing pretend now.
Right.
It was the opposite. I bowed down to them.
Well, they felt welcome and loved, and that's all we can hope for, to work and walk into a creative experience and feel appreciated. Whatever happens after you do it, that's up to the universe. It gets canceled or it gets reordered or whatever.
I appreciated everybody. And what's weird is that I would hug every boom operator and know their name. And they said, I've never worked on a show where the person, you know, knows my name. And I said, what are you talking about? And then I was saying into the hair department, I said, what's the name of that cute guy who's, you know, always with the props or whatever? And they're like, I don't know. And I said, don't you guys know the names? Because I thought you all worked together on Broad City. And they said, yeah, I don't know. So I went to Tony Hernandez, our producer, and said, we're making a Facebook with a little book with everybody's picture, selfie. And he's like, why? And I said, because we will make a better show if these 110 people know each other and we know each other's names.
And instead feel like of a saying, family.
Hey, we're standing next to them and getting the M&Ms at Craft Services.
Exactly.
So I made them do that. And they got an intern to just do it. And everyone said, why is this not on every set? It's ridiculous.
It's true.
So, you know, and I know some sets are 500 people. They probably need it even more. But I was proud of that more than anything else. I was like, this is just something that has to happen. And I do think it became a family.
I think it's everything. I think community is everything. And the idea that one job is more important than the other, or like this person eats first and that, like, I hate all of that.
I hate that.
And I know that you led your set with that. And to be number one on the call sheet is a very big responsibility. You set the tone. We talk a lot about that on the show. And you did it with such grace and generosity, and I cannot wait to see what you do next. I'm so glad you are in good health.
Thank you. I'm so touched. Thank you for having me. You're so nice.
Of course. Anyway, thank you, Jill Cartman. Until next time.
Yay.
Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go. These are little known facts that now you know.
If you want more information about my guests, go to the website littleknownfactspodcast.com. I also wanted to tell you that there is now a new addition to the website. It is a button that says contributions. This podcast is a true labor of love, and I really, really want to keep doing it for a long time. So if you like listening as much as I love to do it, please feel free to contribute. It would mean the world to me. Also, on Twitter, you can find me at Alana Levine. Instagram is Little Known Facts Podcast. And on Facebook, Little Known Facts Podcast. You can also feel free to rate and review the show on the iTunes show page. This podcast is recorded at Hanger Studios in New York City. This episode was brought to you by Pro Media. Located in Times Square, Pro Media offers both production and post-production services out of its beautiful studios in the heart of New York City. Pro Media, sound vision. Find out more at promedia.nyc.